The Lead Icon Podcast.
Shape the future. Lead with purpose. Go iconic.
As a small or medium-sized business, how are you integrating AI or other advanced technology into your business? This also includes how are your employees interacting with advanced technologies? Today, I had the pleasure of interviewing Dragan Gašić, who serves as a special counsel for Black Bay Lawyers, a commercial law firm based in Sydney, Australia. Now, Dragan and I covered a lot of different topics, everything from employment law to how AI is being used by law firms. I hope you enjoy this extremely important interview and that you can take several points away from it so that you can also become more compliant and integrate AI so that it helps your firm stay more competitive. Welcome, Dragan. It's wonderful to meet you in person. We've had a few conversations on the phone, so it's wonderful to put a face to a voice.
Yes, no, thank you for the invite, Diana. It's, looking forward to the discussion.
And the reason why I reached out to you was I was particularly interested in your area of expertise, which is not only law, but also your focus on technology, defamation, and also, I guess, employment law. And yep. With the plethora of changes that are going on in the world, I know that you're very interested in helping guide small businesses and large businesses in making the right decisions. And the firm that you work with also are very much about, you know, helping small business and large businesses in this area. So to start with, what led you to a career in law? Because I know you've got a very rich background and have experienced multiple careers.
Yes, well, I came from the visual and performing arts background before starting the legal education. I've got a degree in creative arts. I double majored in painting and acting. I was actively involved in theatre, film and television. It was rewarding for personal growth and creativity, but at the end of the day, I wanted a sustainable career, and I guess law became a natural transition for that. One of the things that sort of, as a performing artist, you're a storyteller and trained communicator, and you're conveying meaning, you're conveying emotion, and I guess practicing in theatre comes with certain responsibilities. You're responsible to your audience. You're delivering value to your audience. I mean, they're paying for a ticket for an experience. You've got a duty to your directors and your authors. They're bringing their vision to life. You've got a duty to your fellow performers. You've got to work together to bring that vision into reality for the experience for your, not only for yourself, but for your audience. And I guess that artistic experience cultivated sort of key skills and values such as, storytelling, communicating, teamwork, I guess to a certain degree accountability, because you're accountable for your performance on stage and the work ethic you put in before you prepare for your shows. And I guess these skills sort of align naturally with a legal career, motivating me to pursue a career in the bar during my studies. So, and during that stage, I met a person who was a lawyer who became an actor, and that sort of inspired me to go and see a criminal trial, and that was it. I thought, this is for me.
The interesting thing about the performing arts is that it would have taught you, those deep skills such as empathy and being able to read people.
Yeah.
And that would come very handy in law, would you say?
Well, it does. Again, the thing about being an effective communicator, it teaches you how to look at someone and take someone in when you speak to them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I find that skill's lacking. And it's fundamental to be able to, communicate and talk directly to someone, talk to them, not at them or through them or above them or around them. So I found that is a significant skill to have. So yes.
Very important today, especially when we've got so much noise around us.
Yeah.
So if I move now to technology, because we had a chat about, you're writing a book and, you're looking at the implications of technology and AI on, I guess, the world and on business.
Yeah.
So what do you think the I guess what inspired your interest in AI and technology in terms of legal practice?
Well, I guess coming from the background that I've come from, I'm sort of trained to explore patterns, patterns generally, innovation, and identify sort of connections between things. So this sort of mindset naturally aligned with exploring AI's potential and risks and the use of technology as well. So, technology shapes the relationship between facts and belief, and that was a key thing for me. And the impact that has on the justice system and societal structures. So that's the key context in which, technology impacted upon me. So, like for example, AI and social media amplify outrage and rage for engagement. I mean, you've got likes, clicks, and social media tends to keep you in echo chambers. So an outrage, spreads really, really quickly and fast due to moral societal triggers. So AI amplifies that. Personal rage through, I guess, trolling bots and personalization, and you've got the echo chambers that arise as a result of that. So, and in terms of justice, you've got, for example, the public seems to disregard facts at the moment, and you see that sort of playing out in the US at the moment, which affects the views on, judicial outcomes. So, there are broader implications of that, and social consequences. So that for me was a trigger for exploring this. And yeah.
And we'll get into that a bit more as our conversation evolves. What is your, I guess, outlook or view on small business and how they are basically, integrating legal into their enterprises? What are some of the challenges that they are experiencing?
Okay, well, employment law is a big one. There's been a recent Fair Work Commission annual report that provided some really interesting statistics on this. And they've recorded that there've been over 40,000 applications which were received in 2023, 2024, which is a significant increase. I mean, I think it was a 27% increase compared to the previous year. And the industries which were impacted greatly were, for example, aged care, early childhood education. So they mainly related to, wage related disputes. So legislative reforms, pay equity conditions. You've got construction and manufacturing, enterprise agreements relating to those areas. Workforce restructuring, hospitality, retail, they've all sort of increased. Labor hire, gig economy. I mean, the new, there's a piece of legislation called the Closing Loopholes Act, which contributed to these increases. So I guess the data reflects both sector-specific pressures and the growing attention to compliance and workplace fairness. So it's particularly impacting on the employment area. You've got data privacy. You've got staff using their own emails and phones for personal use, which highlight the potential breaches. privacy monitoring. I mean, how a firm monitors the use of staff, confusion over data and IP, cybersecurity risks, discovery, all of those issues. So, and the financial costs. And if you're involved in litigation, that misuse of private information from the company, I mean, how does that work with litigation? And the other factors such as dispute resolution, debt recovery, big thing is for you want to get paid. As a business, you want to get paid. So, and a lot of businesses just, I don't know, they find it difficult to chase bad debt. They don't seem to have systems in place to be able to deal with that properly. They tend to rely on goodwill, but there's no proper systems in place, and they allow debts to run over, 60 days, 90 days, and then it's a question of, spending more money trying to chase that debt. So that's a big one.
You mentioned something around staff using personal phones. And I think a lot of businesses don't realize how important that is, especially because what's the implication of them using their personal phone, say, in their work? Because for example, I observe, you and I both work with different businesses, and then when you're within their realm, you can see people are constantly on their phone. So what do you think, what needs to be done there?
Well, you're using a lot of people are using their text messages, their emails for private use. They could be inadvertently handling their company confidential details and putting them outside of the network, which then implies imports all sort of breaches of confidentiality, particularly for dealing with client information. So you've just got to put in proper policies and procedures, education, and training up staff on the legal implications of those breaches. So training, development, and using technology, particularly if a company is using AI and clients are using large language models, generative AI to for personal and for corporate reasons. So there needs to be greater education about, those technologies.
Yeah, well said. Now, you've segued really well now into AI. So I read a statistic that something like 35% of global businesses, mostly small, medium-sized businesses, will be adopting AI by the end of next year, they say. And $19 billion worth of, I think, extra to GDP will be added just in Australia alone by the adoption of AI. So what are your, I guess, predictions on AI adoption? And we need to sort of, be clear about what we mean by AI, because you've got AI, you've got machine learning, which is what most businesses are adopting, because AI is a completely different beast. So what are you seeing as the necessary, I guess, adoptions businesses are taking up?
Well, I mean, they've got to adapt. It's as simple as that. It's an irreversible technology, and its impacts are being felt today. The transformative opportunities are, I mean, you're seeing them now with automation of repetitive tasks, supply chain optimization, predictive maintenance. That's a big one. Predictive analytics in law, where you've got models which can predict an outcome of the case.
And how do you think that will improve, say, operations and decision making for business leaders?
Well, I mean, automation will certainly streamline things and make life a lot easier, a lot more cost effective. But there's always a massive risk to that, and you've got potential exposure of trade secrets, sensitive data. If staff or executives are using AI to to explore new ways of doing things, or they could be inadvertently disclosing trade secrets. So, so there's a lot of risk associated with that. And the other risk is that there's a lot of hallucinations associated with large language model outputs. I know in law, there's been a massive coverage about case law that doesn't exist. So ChatGPT, for example, can roll out cases that appear on their face to be correct and real, but when you go and find them, you can't find them. And some lawyers have actually used those cases in their submissions, and they've been called out by judges, and it's become part of their judgments, and it's so embarrassing.
I find that astounding because you'd think that they would check the case law, but
Well, I mean,
it talks to how fast-paced our lives are.
well, that, well, it happens, and it's happened. It happens. It's happening as we speak. That's the thing. I mean, a lot of lawyers seem to be afraid of this technology, but when they use it, they're not applying their, how shall I say, their forensic judgment in ensuring that what's been produced by the large language model is actually accurate. So you can't delegate the responsibilities of the lawyer to a machine. I mean, it's non-delegable, our roles and obligations and our duties to the court. They're non-delegable. So you just got to be on top of the technology. And a lot of people understand the technology and its limitations and what it can and can't do.
Now, in terms of employment, I guess employment disputes, as technology becomes more and more embedded, when we talk about, we probably can't even foresee some of these changes that are going to happen. How do you see that impacting, I guess, employment disputes? Like, what trends are we going to see?
Well, I mean, a lot of employers are, I guess that they're implementing monitoring systems like keyloggers, tracking software, CCTV. So you got those issues of privacy, challenges over whether such surveillance complies with laws. You've got employees mishandling sensitive company data. We're seeing that, particularly in relation to the use of emails and phones, which we just discussed. So, you've got misclassification of remote work. There's a lot of concern now with people trying to, well, how should I say this? Where there's been a lot of emphasis of getting contractors to perform the work of employees, to circumvent sort of super obligations and other employment related obligations. So there's a lot of that as well. Discrimination, bias, particularly in relation to hiring processes. I know a lot of firms are using ChatGPT to go through and wade through and review CVs with AI tools. So, that's also a potential ground for litigation. Intellectual property, you've got dismissal, misconduct, you've got work health and safety issues, automation. People are scared for their jobs that, will even lawyers, will automation, remove my, relevance in the legal profession. So they're all sort of issues that are there. But the big ones, are in the employment area.
So
And
what
potential.
do, yes, go
Yeah,
on.
sorry, no,
So
sorry.
what do you suggest, especially with small businesses and, mid-sized firms who, I guess, aren't getting the consultant, like the legal consulting that they need? What do you think they could do to, I guess, cover themselves? Because I'm seeing that also, like when I say an employee is maybe not the right fit, the processes can be quite heavy-handed, and a call with Fair Work Australia would raise your eyebrows because there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. And then there's also the use of retrenchment, to get rid of somebody, that might not be a personality fit, but they're perfectly great employee. So, how do you navigate around that?
Well, you've got to establish, I guess, and enforce clear social media and digital communication policies and internal policies dealing with complaints. You just have to have them. If you don't, then you run the risk of, I mean, particularly as it affects insurance policies as well. I know firms have insurance policies in relation to public liability and management, directors' duties and directors' insurance. And that will be, a large play on having effective, clear policies where disputes can be internally managed to remove any claims that, there are reportable claims, for example, in the insurance area. And then you've got to, my advice is to get legal counsel to go through and establish those policies for a firm. So it's just having secure policies in place and having your employees educated about proper conduct and how to behave and what's expected of them. And then dealing with any problem that arises as soon as it arises, and not allowing it to percolate, and doing it in a fair and responsible way, where that person is supported and they're informed of their rights.
Yes, very, very, very important. Very important because we've noticed in the public arena, large defamation cases like recently with Moira Deeming and Lisa Wilkinson. So I want to talk to you a little bit about defamation because now what you've just said about with especially with content that's being released online, what is the problem there at the moment? Like that seems like it's going to be a Pandora's box. And I was looking at some statistics, and the average defamation payout is something like $300,000. And that's not affordable for many small businesses. And what I'm so we've got this double-edged sword where we've got, like what you've said, this age of rage, but then at the same time, if you catch somebody's eye in the wrong way, you could be really,
Well, that's
dragged through
right.
the courts.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, defamation occurs when a false statement about a person is published, whether it's spoken, written, or online, that harms their reputation. And the elements of defamation are publication needs to be published, so it needs to be communicated to at least one third party. And the statement needs to identify, or reasonably understand to identify that person. And the statement m must cause that person reputational damage. Okay, so But people have truth as a defense. So a statement won't be considered defamatory if it's proven that it's true. So the important thing for companies is to monitor and respond to online content. So, companies can use tools to monitor their businesses' presence and monitor for defamatory conduct. So, and the company just needs to respond professionally and factually to negate reviews or false claims and avoid public escalation. But it's important to train your staff about what defamation is and what conduct constitutes, defamatory statements. So, my advice is seek legal advice and, leverage your protections, have any sensitive content review before you publish it. It's as simple as that.
So when it comes to now, this is another issue now in terms of, now that we're digitizing and, we're really open to, I guess, cyber attacks, what advice would you give to business in terms of how to protect themselves from cyber attacks? Because a lot of businesses aren't setting themselves up for success in that area.
Yeah. Well, I mean, other than the obvious, putting in place of security measures, firewalls, encryption, employee training. I mean, that's just, the big one. I mean, you've got to educate your staff. Your staff must recognize when, for example, when there are phishing attempts or other, engineered attacks. So you've got to promote best practices and for secure passwords as well. So, and again, incident reporting, policies. It's all in the policies. It's education, and engaging with expert support. Engage with a partner with cyber security expertise, who manage your services, and that will, greatly reduce your risk.
Now, you mentioned earlier on about debt, and it can, once you let your receivables extend out of 60 days, it's harder to basically collect. And so there's something like in Australia, $4 billion is sitting in uncollected debt due to people not enforcing or not acting on time. So you mentioned that one of the major problems is, acting on time. What else? What are some of the best practices that businesses can enforce to ensure that they don't or they minimize this area?
Well, credit checks. Do your credit checks before you engage with them. You've got and set clear payment terms in your engagement letters or in or your retainer agreements. Streamline your invoicing, leverage technology. It's there. You've got technology there that can help you. And if your customer is having problems, enter into repayment plans. Negotiate a structured repayment option to recover the debt. I've found that being respectful and engaged with clients that don't pay often understand and you get a positive result. Those that you don't, you're just going to have to engage professionals, and review your internal policies and engage professionals who can help
No,
you.
we have extensive experience in this area too, Dragan, because what we found was that people don't negotiate terms very well, and you can have a staggered payment approach so that it's not all waiting at the end. And especially with small business, when cash flow is so important, there's got to be a bit more regular payments. So that's good advice that you've given. Now, in terms of the future of law, I'm really keen to explore this because when you look at lawyers, Lawyers are very, I gotta say, you've got to be precise. You use the example of ChatGPT, sprouting wrong case law. Now, what do you think in terms of how will AI affect the legal profession? Because, there's this doom and gloom out there about, it's going to replace all these jobs. I can't see that because there's a lot of creative and problem solving, and humans are very unpredictable. What's your take on this?
Well, look, I mean, the technology is there to automate factors such as contract review. I mean, it speeds up contract analysis. It sort of removes that human error when you're doing a contract analysis. You've got predictive analytics, as I indicated earlier. I mean, you can now sort of predict, what an outcome could be for your client's case based on previous cases. You've got e-discovery tools which can help analyze vast volumes of data, thousands of pages in minutes that would otherwise take paralegals or support staff, hours or days to do. Chatbots, I mean, now can handle routine client inquiries. Admin tasks, streamlining repetitive tasks. That's what it's used for at the moment. I mean, summarizing case summaries. I know a lot of lawyers are using it to draft letters and emails, but there are risks.
So how do we mitigate those risks? Because when you look at, I read a stat where it said it potentially will save 1.5 million hours for somebody. And we know time is the metric that, the legal profession uses, and I guess professional services. So how can we mitigate those risks? Do we go into a more closed AI system? That's,
Well,
that what is
that's
that?
where that's where it's tending towards. I mean, the larger firms and larger organizations are developing their own sort of closed systems. But lawyers now are still using open source large language models like ChatGPT and Claude. But what we can do is, I mean, as solicitors, understand the technology that you're working with. Get to know it. And get to know what it can and what it cannot do. And I've just got to highlight a case where in July of this year, a solicitor submitted some submissions in the Federal Circuit and Family Court, and he provided, some cases, and the judge and the other side just couldn't identify these cases, and this is in Australia. So the lawyer admitted that the list of cases was generated by some legal software that he used, which had an AI capability. And the judge questioned the lawyer's competency and ethics due to his reliance on unverified AI-generated cases. So highly embarrassing for the lawyer, but it just emphasizes that lawyers need to take responsibility to verify everything that's generated from the system, and to ensure that no confidential communication is inputted into the system. And therein lies the fear. But I mean, the key takeaway there is that you've got to balance efficiencies that AI provides with vigilance. I mean, you've just got to be vigilant, and the tendency of AI is it's to make you more reliant on it. It sort of takes it makes you lazy, if you rely on it too much, and if you do that, if you don't, like I said, you can't delegate your responsibilities. We've got to exercise our forensic judgment in the best interest of the clients and the truth, to maintain the truth. And you've just got to verify everything that comes out of that out of the large language model.
You mentioned the word truth, and we hit that like postmodern world, post-truth world now, and there's a concept, truth decay, that's been floating around for a few years, and I actually had to look it up because I wasn't very, I guess, I didn't understand it. And even though I should, because of the line of work I'm in, and then I came across a book by was it Kavanagh and Rich, which they wrote a book called The Truth Decay. And one of the things that they talked about were the drivers around truth decay, which was cognitive, I guess, was it cognitive prejudice and diminishing reliance on facts. So can you expand on what does truth decay actually mean, and what its implications are on our society and on our businesses today?
Well, truth decay is the growing inability to distinguish fact from opinion. So it's fueled by misinformation, disinformation, erosion of trust in traditional sources. I mean, you've seen that play out in the US at the moment, where there's an attack on judiciary, the spread of conspiracy theories. And the dangers of that is the public will not trust the judiciary. I mean, the judiciary's role there is to look at facts, make a determination on them to come to a truth. Now, some people won't accept that as truth and will continue to believe that a fact or a scenario or circumstances that have gone through the justice system are somehow wrong. And they will firmly believe an alternate reality. I mean, it's just, and the impact on courts is that it threatens the court's ability to fulfill their role as fact finders, especially in the digital information age. So the challenges for judges is an increasing difficulty ensuring that the evidence is accurate. And that's the other danger too. The use of technology where facts are moshed together and spread online. Fact laundering is another one where I guess unverified facts are given credence through, I guess, reputable legacy media organizations, and they're somehow taken as a truth, as an alternate truth. So, yeah, there's a lot of challenges. And our role as lawyers, I mean, we've got to uphold that trust, and part of our obligations is to ensure that, what we do and how we do it, there is a firm fixation on getting to the truth and relying on facts rather than going on beliefs and continuing to sort of spread that misinformed, misdirected notion of what facts are.
This is a very difficult area because, you get to the point, it's come to the point where it's, people will say, well, your facts are different to my facts. And my first question I always ask someone is, where did you get your information from? And 90% of the time, people will say news rather than actually look to peer review research, look at cases, look at reports. And because we now live in a society where, I heard something like the average concentration span is now less than a goldfish. It's like 7 seconds. So if we've got that problem now, so that means that we've got more people who are relying on bite-sized information. How do we then disseminate truth in a short, I guess, bite-sized way? That will be our challenge.
Yeah, it will be our challenge, and I think I guess that's a that would be a challenge of how judgments are delivered publicly. Anyway, that's a thing for the future. But you're right. I mean, the way that we receive our news now is through X, formerly known as Twitter. A lot of people receive their news from there. in a bite-sized, sensationalist way, which AI is programmed to sensationalize and appeal to your emotional triggers. So it is a danger, and I guess as lawyers, we've just got to be aware of that and maintain adherence to facts, and not sprout beliefs and unsubstantiated arguments. So.
And we've lost the art of debate. That's another, I think, collateral damage to our society. Now, in terms of practical strategies for business, what do you think are like with respect to confidential information? We touched on, having education and policy in place. How can we use technology to actually safeguard our confidential information, like IP? For example, I noticed that a lot of businesses don't even have their logos or their names trademarked. They rely on certain things. So in terms of those sorts of confidential information, what steps can we do to protect our sensitive data? Because all our data is on third-party platforms now.
No, that's an issue that comes up a fair bit in my practice. I always tell clients that whenever you're engaging an employee or a contractor, to enter into an agreement. There's a lot of people that just don't enter into employment agreements or contractor agreements, and they engage them on a handshake or some informal way, and it just exposes that business to that person coming in and using their not only their trade secrets, their business model. Some people have gone in and copied a business model from their contracting party, and it's difficult when something's based on trust. You really need to have your relationship defined in a contract, in a written agreement that sets out clear terms what the rights and obligations are and how confidential information is to be treated. Otherwise, it's very difficult to claw back any leverage that you would otherwise have by having a written contract in place, and also having a good cybersecurity and system in place where that information is protected. But get your documents in order. Get your documents in order.
Now, that feels relatively, I guess, easy if it's within Australia. But say, for example, if you're like me, where your team is spread around the world, it's a bit harder to enforce, I guess, a dispute if you're, sorry, to commence a dispute if somebody's living in a different country. What advice can you give to, businesses that have a more like a hybrid setup?
Well, finding out who you're dealing with, do some due diligence on the other party and where they're located, where they are registered, where they reside. If you're dealing with that person on an individual basis or as a corporate entity, find out whether that jurisdiction can recognise any judgment that's obtained in our jurisdiction, and whether it can be enforced in that other jurisdiction. So due diligence, again, having contracts in place that are drawn in your favour, where if any dispute has arisen, then you would nominate that Australia or New South Wales be the appropriate jurisdiction where such disputes can be heard and determined. So it's all in the contract, and that's why you really need to engage in, get a lawyer who can advise you on these issues.
No, okay. The next sort of 5 years, it's a bit of a mixed bag. Some are saying that we're going to hit some really growth, hit a growth period. Then others are doom and gloom. The economy is going to fall apart. War. What do you think businesses should do to prepare for such scenarios?
Well, understand their environment that they're working in, understand the technology. And just going back to what we've discussed, train your staff and put policies in place, ensure that you've got proper advice, understand the climate that you're working in. But the technology is a big one because it will change how we work, how we think, how we engage with each other. So it's just understanding all aspects of where your business is, what it does, and how it operates, and make sure that you've got good advice, accounting, legal, and technical advice. So that's fairly fundamental, but a significant issue one will be your relationship with your employees, because they're the ones that are handling your sensitive information and your rights and responsibilities towards one another. So
And if you were to put your futurist hat on now, we're 10 years, you and I are, catching up in 10 years' time. What would it look like? What do you think our day-to-day will look like?
Well, one thing that we will encounter is that our clients will become more AI enabled and educated. So they will be expecting more for less to a certain degree. So I think the nature of legal services will need to adapt to that. That will present certain new opportunities. But it certainly won't replace lawyers. You'll find more remote style services being performed, which is a shame. But I think that personal connection is always important, and it shouldn't go away. And I don't think it will. But an AI enabled client will certainly be at the forefront. And I guess, guide the next phase of legal development and products.
You're absolutely right. The human connection aspect of our, that's our humanity. So that may get, pushed a little bit to the tech side, but then I think it'll balance itself back because the technology side is more about enabling us to be more efficient, to deliver, to offer a better service, elevate our excellence. And I know just from experience, and you would have seen it too, that you've always got a small percentage of people who are more conscientious than others. So that others will piggyback off the conscientious, So in terms of predictions for next year, I'd like to close out with what are your top three predictions for business? Like, what do we really have to get our heads around in order to be able to compete?
Understand your technology. I can't emphasize enough understanding the tools that you are using. We all use tools. We all have a toolbox, understand the tools that you're using. What will become more increased is more closed source large language models that a lot of law firms are now using. That will allow for more, I guess, more confidential, secure client information and details. That will increase. Look, AI will become a fundamental part of legal practice. I think the billing systems of law firms will need to factor in the AI component of what work was done through AI and what work wasn't. I think clients will become more demanding about knowing how AI is being used in their matters. So costing in the billing system, that will be a significant feature. And new products which are yet to be created through an AI-enabled client. And it may well be that there could be products that are created by law firms, around specific needs, client needs, a bespoke product offering for a bespoke problem that law firms will create using technology to service their clients.
It's exciting. It's
Yeah,
very
it is.
exciting because it
Absolutely.
can, like, we can actually get to the root of some of the problems that have been, that appear unsolvable, especially from a business operations point of view.
Yeah, that's right.
Dragan, where can people reach you? Because your area of expertise is, across commercial employment law. Now with technology, where can people reach you so that they can get the right advice?
Well, we are at I'm at Black Bay Lawyers. We are based in Sydney, in Castlereagh Street in Sydney. So, blackbaylawyers.com.au, I believe.
Excellent. We'll put that also in the credits for you so that if anybody wants to reach out to you, they can. Thank you so much for your valuable time and for sharing, I think, really important information for our listeners because, if you're a small business, you really have to get your legal affairs in
Absolutely.
order. Thank you, Dragan.
No, thank you for the invitation.